It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, I'll talk with reporter Jude Joffe Block about tonight's community meeting in Guadalupe on the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. It'll be led by Robert Warshaw, who's been appointed to monitor the MCSO. Also, a Tempe High School football coach was suspended for violating school rules by praying with his team. How unique is that situation, and why do sports and religion seem to intersect so much? Plus, the well-known story of infamous Phoenix murderer Winnie Ruth Judd may not have been completely true. The cover story in this week's Phoenix New Times includes a confession letter by Judd that was only recently made public. We start today's program with Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema, who represents Arizona's 9th District. We also invited her Republican opponent Wendy Rogers to join us, but never received an official response. Representative Sinema, good morning.
Well, good morning, Steve. It's great to be with you.
So what changes need to be made at the VA, and how quickly can they be made?
Well, gosh, that's a long list. I wish we had more time to talk. You know, when I met with Secretary McDonald for the second time last week, I reiterated a long list of changes that need to be made at the VA. But first and foremost, the VA has to fundamentally change its culture so that veterans are put first. Not salary, not bonuses, not saving money. It's got to be veterans first. And we haven't seen that culture change yet at the VA. In terms of rapidity of getting this done, as you know, Congress passed a law in July. The president signed it into law. And I urge Secretary McDonald to move much, much more rapidly in implementing that law. And most importantly, to tell Arizonans when he's made progress. So, for instance, last week he said, we have 1,000 new positions we get to hire in Phoenix at the VA. He's hired 140 of them. But nobody knew that. And there's still, 860 left. So I'm encouraging him to move at a much more rapid pace to implement these reforms. The bottom line is, while bureaucracy is slow, veterans can't wait for bureaucracy, and they can't wait for slow.
How especially troublesome is it that this whole conflict, the whole controversy became public in Phoenix?
Well, I think it's incredibly concerning. You know, Dr. Foote, according to his own testimony in Congress, had been reaching out internally for some time, never getting a response. It wasn't until he reached out to both Congress and reporters at the Arizona Republic that this even came to light. And what we've seen from early reports from the VA, including at the IG's office, the Inspector General office, is a slowness to take responsibility and accept the reality of the situation we're in. My opinion is we need to move past that, just acknowledge the responsibility rests with the VA, and move forward towards fixing it.
Now, for many people, Congress and moving slowly really fit together. And I wonder, is this going to be one of those where once the headlines go away, even as more soldiers keep coming back, that if it's out of the headlines, Congress won't pay as much attention to it?
You know, Steve, I think that's a real danger. And that's why I've made a promise to the constituents of my district that not only did we push really hard to get these VA reforms passed in July and signed into law by the president, but now it's my job to bird dog the VA until they actually implement all these reforms. So even if it falls out of popularity or people stop paying attention, it's still going to be the number one priority for our office. And we're just going to keep pushing until it gets done.
You're in the minority, though.
That's right.
Is that hard, or an issue like this, is the gap bridged more?
You know, Steve, as you know, I've always served in the minority, and my experience has been that bipartisanship is not difficult if you're willing to form relationships and make friends with people who are different than yourself. On veterans issues in particular, the ability to find bipartisan agreement is broad, and the chair of the committee, Representative Jeff Miller of Florida, has shown a great deal of leadership and inclusiveness in bringing Republicans and Democrats together in the House to solve this problem.
You had a very affecting TV ad with a couple who lost their son, and they give you a lot of credit. You also receive some criticism for that ad, and I wonder how you respond to that.
You know, the issue of taking care of veterans is a very personal one for me, Steve. I come from a long line of family service in the military. My grandpa earned a Purple Heart in World War II. He was in the Army. My stepfather served in the Army in Vietnam, and my big brother served as a Marine. And my little brother is still serving today. He's a gunner's mate in the U.S. Navy, stationed in California. So this is a very personal issue for me, and it has been throughout my entire public service. So the commercial that we made about the work we're doing to ensure that no other veteran feels so alone that he takes his own life, as Daniel did, is very personal to me. And I'm willing to accept some criticism if folks think that that's the wrong way to move forward. I personally feel it's the right way to move forward. And the legislation that we talk about in that ad that I'm working with Sergeant Somers' parents on actually passed committee just last week. Representative Jeff Miller included it in a large omnibus bill around veterans' mental health, which nearly assures its passage through the House. That's something I'm really proud of, and it's the work I'll continue to do, regardless of how some folks feel about it.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Representative Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona's 9th District. Airstrikes against ISIS in Syria. President Obama has decided to take that action, asked for congressional support for part of the action. How important do you think it is for the U.S. to be aggressive going against ISIS? Is this the right way to go?
You know, Steve, I've been thinking a lot, obviously, about ISIS, as most members of Congress, and frankly, I think much of the country has. And I look at it really from three guiding principles. And the first guiding principle I have to think about is making sure that we're protecting American lives and American homeland. So any action we take or choose not to take has to be related directly, first and foremost, to that first principle, protecting American lives and the American homeland. Number two, protecting American soldiers and service members. So I oppose putting boots on the ground in Syria and Iraq. I don't think it's the right solution, either in the short term or the long term. And the third principle is to encourage the Arab community to take control of its own future in this region and become involved. We've seen in the recent airstrikes large participation from Arab countries. I think that's important. Mm-hmm. And my opinion is that as we move forward, that it's the administration's duty to communicate regularly with Congress. It's my duty then to communicate regularly with my constituents, but to make my decisions in light of those three guiding principles.
And how public should the president be on the policies? Is this something that the American people need to know more about? Is in some ways this a manner of giving away secrets?
You know, I think we have to always try and balance transparency and accountability with, obviously, protecting state secrets. But frankly, Steve, I'm not sure that that is a challenge. In this situation, the criticism has largely been about lack of transparency and accountability. So I support the administration telling absolutely as much as possible to the American public. These are their tax dollars that are being used. It's our reputation that's on the line, and it's our country's future. So I think the public should have access to the greatest amount of information possible without jeopardizing national security.
Coming back to ads more generally, somehow you've escaped that ad, the sign with President Obama's face and yours right next to it. Overall, what do you think about what the administration has done? And I mean domestic policy, foreign policy. If you had to give them a grade, what would it be?
Gosh, you're asking a teacher to give a grade. That's something I do a lot. It's actually my least favorite part of teaching. You probably know this, Steve, but I still teach at ASU even now while I'm serving in Congress. And I would say that there are some areas where I think the administration could do a much better job. One of the issues that I recently was frustrated about was the lack of communication between the administration and the state of Arizona around the unaccompanied minor crisis. You know, the governor didn't get notice, local members of Congress didn't get notice, local communities didn't get notice, and so we were not well prepared for that influx of women and children. And I think it was incumbent on the administration to share that information and help us prepare, and to talk about this influx in a way that allowed the community to better prepare. There's another couple examples, I think. One thing I am grateful for is the current administration's choice to talk about the strikes against ISIS, I feel, are good. So what we saw in the last 2 days has been helpful. And I hope that that level of transparency and accountability and conversation with the American public continues. In terms of a relationship with Congress, I would like to see the administration have a more open and closer relationship with Congress. The only way we're really going to move forward on the big issues of the day, solving a budget, resolving the immigration crisis, is with cooperation and bipartisan action, and we sure could use more of that.
And I guess trust comes in there. Is there not enough mutual trust?
You know, I can't speak for others, but I think that from the outside looking in, it doesn't appear that there is significant trust. And of course, that's a two-way street. So I always encourage everyone to come to the table, sit down, let's order some sandwiches, shut the door, and solve the problem.
Still didn't get a grade, though.
I hate grading. It's the worst part of my job. Oh. Give me a little bit of time to think about that one.
Okay. Immigration reform. You mentioned the unaccompanied minors. Is immigration reform going to be something? And if not, who are we going to blame?
You know, I don't think that immigration reform is likely to happen this year. I mean, Congress goes back into session on November the 12th, right after Veterans Day, and has about a month of work to do. And there are some big items on the table. One of the biggest is the reauthorization of terrorism risk insurance. That's a huge deal right here in Arizona. And we've got to get this work done. So I think it's unlikely that you see immigration reform happen before the end of this year. And frankly, I think it's premature to predict what will happen in the next Congress. We don't know who's going to be elected in either the House or the Senate. So I think it would be too premature to predict that. What I can say is this. Arizonans are waiting. We are ground zero for Congress's lack of action on the issue of immigration. And the statistics are very clear that immigration reform is an economic imperative for Arizona's future. And as we know, two-thirds of Arizonans support comprehensive reform. The time is now, but since it won't happen now, the time is also tomorrow and the next day. And my job is to continue to work across the aisle to find that collaborative middle ground to get this done.
We have very little time left, but I do want to ask you about the Affordable Care Act. You were a very, very early supporter of that, even when you were in the legislature. People have had some complaints about it. In some cases, premiums are higher than they expected. In some cases, people got kicked off their current plan. What's working there? What isn't? How much tweaking needs to be done?
Well, I would say a significant amount of tweaking is yet to be done. There are some tenets of the Affordable Care Act that make a lot of sense, protecting kids from being kicked off insurance when they develop a disease or disorder like autism, ensuring that women who develop breast cancer don't get a cancellation notice after they're diagnosed, ensuring that most of the spending goes into actual care and not overhead. Those are all great parts of the law, but there are some problems with the law. The exchanges haven't worked out quite as effectively as were intended, and there's also some unforeseen costs that have been passed on to consumers. And that's why I've co-sponsored legislation to fix those elements of the law. Several times I've voted for legislation to allow people to keep their plans if they like them, the plans they had from before. That was a promise the president made. It's one that I think should be honored. I also supported the 40-hour work week so that folks who are working multiple part-time jobs don't get penalized and kicked off of health care. And I also support things like repealing the medical device tax because that gets passed directly onto the consumer. And if you need to get, a device to help your heart continue working, you probably can't afford to pay that extra tax. So I think what we have to find is a common sense middle ground to fix the parts of the law that aren't working and protect the parts of the law that are working. And it's my hope that Congress can move forward on some of these bipartisan fixes in the coming years.
And finally, what was your grade of the Obama administration?
I think I'm going to have to say probably a C. And I would say we've had some real issues around, for instance, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Not a great communication with Congress around issues that are important like immigration. And I'm hoping to see better in the future.
Arizona's 9th District Congressional Representative, Kirsten Sinema, thank you.
Thanks so much.
And as a reminder, we did offer Republican opponent Wendy Rogers a chance, never got back to us officially. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Tonight, the court-appointed monitor in the racial profiling case against the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office is holding a community meeting in the town of Guadalupe. It's the second meeting of its kind, and it's coming on the heels of a new report from the Monitor on the progress the Sheriff's Office has and hasn't made to make court-ordered changes in the agency. Joining me now in the studio is KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block. Hello.
Hello.
Now, Jude, one reason why tonight's meeting will be interesting is because there's a wrought history between the Sheriff's Office and Guadalupe. It's a small town of just a few thousand people, so it contracts with the Sheriff's Office for policing, but they've had tension. Remind us of the history here.
So remember, Guadalupe has this interesting demographic background. It has people who identify as Yaqui Indian, which is a group originally from Mexico, as well as Mexican immigrants. And back in 2008, the sheriff's office led one of its famous crime suppression sweeps in Guadalupe. It was very controversial. Arpaio had said in his press release that he'd come because Guadalupe town leaders said there was a problem with unauthorized immigrants. But on the first day of those sweeps, the Guadalupe mayor, Rebecca Jimenez, confronted the sheriff to object to him saying that the town officials had not said that, and that confrontation was caught on video.
You said that you don't want us back here tomorrow? Is that what you said?
But we will be back here tomorrow, full force.
I think you're good.
One more thing. If you don't like the way I operate, you go get your own police department. You got 90 days. To cancel your contract. 90 days. You want to cancel it? Feel free to do it.
And that footage made it into a PBS special on Sheriff Arpaio in 2009. But Jude, what's happened since that confrontation?
Right. So Guadalupe has retained its contract with MCSO, but they demanded that the 11 deputies who continue to police the area go through cultural training that explains the town's heritage and celebrations, and that funding for that training was approved by the Board of Supervisors earlier this year.
Let's talk a little about the format of tonight's meeting in Guadalupe. How open a forum is it going to be? Is Robert Warshaw, the court monitor, going to be running it? How much involvement is there going to be?
Well, we've had one of these meetings before. That was back in June. It was held in Phoenix at a high school in downtown. And so I suspect that this meeting will be similar. That one was run by Robert Warshaw and had an opportunity for members of the public to speak and be heard and comment. And that one had a robust presence from MCSO as well. And this time, the sheriff's office tells me that Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan and Chief David Tromby will be there, as well as some public affairs folks.
And this meeting's coming on the heels of a new quarterly report, which is out by Robert Warshaw, as we mentioned, the court monitor. What did he say about MCSO, its relationship with the broader community?
And that report in its conclusion says, "We find that MCSO enjoys only a distant relationship with the community it serves." It also said that there are concerns that the organization doesn't embrace community collaboration or have the requisite sensitivity to the people impacted by the discrimination that the court found. And, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that originally when Judge Snow, who's overseeing the case, wrote up his order about all the changes that should happen, the piece about community engagement involved a community advisory board and these mandatory community meetings. And initially, the sheriff's office was supposed to host those meetings and play a role on that community advisory board. But because of resistance from the sheriff's office, the judge ended up making the monitor in charge of that, taking on that position. And that does sort of seem to speak to this same issue that the monitor is pointing out.
Has the MCSO commented on how Robert Warshaw characterized that relationship?
So Tim Casey, the lawyer who represents the sheriff's office, did object to that characterization, said something to the Associated Press about how that wasn't a fair characterization.
And Jude, you went to some of these community meetings when it was the sheriff's office responsibility to hold them. What's different about Robert Warshaw hosting him as far as the atmosphere, the environment?
Yeah, I went to two of the meetings before the monitor took over this capacity. Both of the ones I went to were outside. One was held, just the Saturday before Christmas on a Saturday morning outside. It was quite cold. There were no chairs. It really wasn't a very friendly atmosphere, and there wasn't a lot of dialogue with the community either. It was actually very poorly attended, both of the ones I went to. By contrast, the one that the monitor held in downtown Phoenix in June was very well attended, about 200 people there. So really kind of night and day.
What did Warshaw say about any areas of potential progress the MCSO seems to be making?
Right, and remember, you know, the judge has said that these changes have to be made, you know, that the deadline for all those changes hasn't come yet. So there's still time, and there's still a lot to be done. But the monitor did point out that the compliance unit has been very responsive to all of the monitor's requests in working with them. That's the team at the sheriff's office in charge of making these changes. So it sounds like that relationship seems to be going okay. And the agency has started gathering traffic stop data. They started doing that in April, so they're on their way to getting some more data that can hopefully be analyzed in the future.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block with the latest on tonight's community meeting between MCSO and Guadalupe. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out why a Tempe Prep football coach was suspended. We'll also find out about new evidence related to a very, very old infamous murder in Phoenix's history. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by MidFirst Private Bank, offering private banking, wealth and investment management, and trust services. More information at midfirstprivatebank.com. Member FDIC.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. BBC NewsHour comes your way at 1 this afternoon. That's followed at 2 by The World. Around the state right now, 77 degrees in Flagstaff. It's 83 in Prescott, 93 in Casa Grande, 92 in Tucson, and 101 degrees right now in Yuma. If you're traveling south of the valley right now, be advised on I-10 northbound, there's a crash at the state route 347. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Mr. Jim Seward and Ms. Julie Karsis, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. It's 95 degrees in Phoenix at 1126.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The head football coach at Tempe Prep, Tommy Britton, is in the midst of serving a 2-game suspension. It's related to his participation in a team prayer led by his son Isaiah. But the act of praying in and of itself, of bringing religion to the team, isn't the precise reason for the suspension. It's technically more administrative than that. With me for a few minutes to talk about it is Scott Bordeaux of the Arizona Republic, who wrote a recent column about the situation, which included a mention that he has a nephew who's a student at Tempe Prep. Scott, good morning.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. So what are the details behind the coach's suspension?
Well, what happened, there was a game against Sholo, I think about 3 weeks ago now, and after the game, the coach asked his son Isaiah to lead the team in prayer. Last year, in 2013, Tempe Prep included in their handbook a new policy that forbids teachers and coaches from organizing prayer or promoting a certain religion in accordance with state and federal law. And Coach Britton, who's a beloved figure on that campus, had prayed several times and organized prayer, and the administrators had constantly warned him, you can't do that. And when he asked his son to do it after the Sholo game, they finally said, we have to suspend you for 2 games because this has been going on. We've been warning you that you're violating school policy, and you didn't stop, so that's why he was handed the 2-game suspension.
What else should we know about the coach, Scott? Is he someone who wears his faith on his sleeve? Is he someone that would test boundaries, as the headmaster has indicated?
I don't think there's any question. Yeah, Tommy Britton does wear his faith. He's a devoted Christian. He has deep beliefs. He is well respected on campus. I mean, he's a good man. There's no question about that. This isn't a bad guy. This is a guy who believes in all the right things. But I do think he believes so strongly in his faith that he was probably testing the policy. I mean, when you think about it, Steve, we see coaches praying with their teams all the time, before games, after games, over a fallen prayer, and really nothing's done. But Tempe Prep, in this case, is a public charter school. It said they want to be in accordance with federal and state law. They had their policy, and I think Coach Britton was testing him, and they finally said enough is enough and suspended him.
So how much tension has resulted from that when it comes from parents, even when it comes from the players?
Well, I think any time you're talking about religion, you're talking about an emotional issue. And I think it was very emotional the first week. 2 days ago, I think it was Coach Britton and the headmaster, David Baum, came out with a joint statement, said, we look forward to putting this behind you. The administration expressed its support for Coach Britton. He'll be back after Friday's game. So I think in the end, everybody will be fine. But I do think in the last 5 or 6, 7 days, there's been a lot of emotion on both sides.
Scott, you had a really interesting line in your recent column. And so I want to ask you the question based on that, which is, does this feel like a situation to you that seems more about freedom to worship as a Christian than freedom of religion more generally?
I think it has more to do with freedom of religion generally. I did put the line in, if he had been a Muslim who wanted his players to pray to Allah, what would the reaction have been in the Tempe Prep community? I'm guessing it would have been outrage from everybody who wasn't a Muslim. Coach Britton, the players can pray by themselves. There's nothing against that. They can organize their own prayer. He just can't, as an officer of the school, lead that prayer. To me, this was more about an employer and an employee in the relationship there. Now an employee has to follow the rules of the employer, even if he has the best of intentions, which I think Coach Britton did. I don't think he did this out of spite. I think he thought it was good for the team. He believes in prayer. But again, if your employer has rules as an employee, you have to follow them or suffer the consequences. And that's what happened here.
Well, then coming back to Coach Britton more specifically, is this a case we already talked about? Maybe he's someone who tests boundaries and also wears his religion on his sleeve. Do you think he was making a larger point, or was this more about him and his team?
I think for maybe a little bit of both. I think it was more about him and his team. I think he believes in prayer, and I think he believes that he wants to glorify God. I think he believes that prayer could bond his team in a way. Whether he was making a larger point, I don't know. I haven't talked to him. He hasn't really commented a whole lot about this. I think it was more about him and his team because they prayed for so long together, and he's organized prayer that I think he was just seeing if he could continue to do that, and the school would just kind of look the other way, and the school finally said no.
Scott, you covered sports for a number of years. As you mentioned, this can be a really sensitive, emotional topic. How sensitive a subject is this in locker rooms, and how often can it affect team chemistry? And I mean bringing teams together or separating them.
It can do both, and it can. It's very. It can have a lot of effects. You look at the Mesa Mountain View softball team. Several months ago, three girls were kicked off the team, and the families allege it was because they weren't Mormon. Now, the school denied that, but that's what happens when you bring religion into a locker room. And I'll use this example. If the coach organizes a prayer, and I said this in the column, and one of the starting players is an atheist, a Muslim, or somebody that doesn't believe in Christianity or praying to Jesus Christ, is that player going to feel excluded from his team in some way? Or even worse, is that player going to feel that maybe his playing time will be compromised because he doesn't believe what the coach believes in? Look, I'm a Christian, so I believe in prayer, and I believe what Coach Britton does, but I think there's a danger of bringing it to a locker room. It can bind the team, but it can also serve the purpose of excluding some players.
Scott, finally, as you said, I mean, this is about an administrative thing. There were rules at Tempe Prep, but I want you to branch out slightly from that. Is this a much more sensitive topic because we're talking about kids here as opposed to professionals who can maybe more readily and more comfortably decide to take part or not take part?
Well, sure. If you're an NFL player, you see NFL players all the time praying after games. They're adults. They're making their own decision. The coach is never asking them to pray in the NFL. But in high school, you know, these 15, 16, 17-year-old kids, the coach makes all the rules. He dictates who plays, who doesn't, who's on the team, who isn't. So it is more sensitive because if the coach organizes his prayer and believes that everybody should be praying and one of his kids doesn't, it can lead to some, you know, dangerous consequences. And that's why I think it's more of a troubling issue in high school than it is at other levels of sports.
Scott Bordeaux of the Arizona Republic. Scott, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Religion's been playing a more prominent role in college and professional sports in recent years. Players who've succeeded aren't shy in thanking God in radio and TV interviews. With me for a few minutes to talk about that is Brett Honeycutt. He's the managing editor of Sports Spectrum magazine. Hi, Brett. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So, Brett, in general, how much of a role should religion, should faith play in a team's activities? Should it be something that teams are sort of involved in as a group, or should it be more about personal choice, that sort of thing? Is there more pressure for teams to be involved in that as individuals?
You know, I guess, you know, I heard your the guy that was on before, and, you know, heaven forbid if any kid should pray, you know, period. I mean, I can't believe that people would have an issue with somebody praying. If I came up to somebody who's not a believer and I said, hey, I'm praying for you because you have cancer, heaven forbid that person should be offended that I would be praying that they would be healed, or that praying that we should have a good game, or praying for the safety of the kids, or praying that we play well, or praying that we have good sports, you know, pray that we have good sportsmanship. And that's where I don't understand that side of people having an issue with prayer. And I do get that not everybody's a Christian. I do get that people, you know, may say that they're offended, but how about the people that are offended who can't pray because somebody says that the coach can't do that? Or how about the people who are offended because they say that, you know, hey, we don't want the kids praying because, you know, it might offend some people who are not Christians on the team, but it's also offending the people who are on the team who do want to pray. So, I mean, it's a two-way street. I heard the guy on the before saying that, you know, it might have dangerous consequences to somebody on the team. Dangerous consequences. I don't know too many coaches who want their kids to pray that would take it out on a player for not praying. I don't really know any, to be honest with you. But I find that hard to believe that there would be dangerous consequences, because a coach in general,
right,
is preparing his team to win, and he wants to win. So why would he suspend somebody for not praying, or take it out on a kid for not praying if that kid's going to help him?
Well,
so that doesn't really jive with what I've seen or what I know about Ford, high school, college, pro, or anything.
Okay, Brad, I do want to come back to what you said, though. I think it's an interesting point, but I think that even Scott, our previous guest, was saying that you're not limiting the fact that if there are children who feel very strongly about praying, that they certainly have the opportunity to pray as individuals. That's why I want to get into this idea of, I think you're right, if you're taking away this person's freedom to pray, but why should they have to pray as a team? Is that something where potentially, I mean, obviously dangerous is a dramatic word for it, but is that a position where you're sort of forcing people to do what they're not comfortable with without taking away the rights of those who are comfortable with it?
I see what you're saying. And it would be, I guess it would be easy for the coach then to say, and I've seen this done before too, in high school sports, in public school, hey, guys, we're going to pray. If anybody feels uncomfortable not praying, you don't have to bow your head, you don't have to close your eyes, you don't have to pray, you don't have to do anything. And that should be available for the people who don't want to pray. And then the coach should also say, hey, guys, for those of you who want to pray, I want you to have that opportunity to pray. So I guess if you're giving somebody the opportunity not to pray, shouldn't you also give them the opportunity to pray? And so, and can you do it as a team? Yeah, I mean, you're giving the people the right to not pray. I mean, there was an issue in college basketball about, what, 4 or 5 years ago, where a player did not want to do pledge allegiance to the flag. They did not want to pledge allegiance. You know, they do it for every sporting event. Well, that college, they allowed that player not to do that. They could sit down. They didn't have to put their hand over their heart. And so, but they still did that. So still looking at a collective group of people doing doing things, and then somebody, in this case it was one person, but it could be multiple people that did not want to do that, and they didn't do it. So opportunities were given for both to do it or not to do it, and I think you can do it as a team. I mean, think about it. I mean, there's a high school coach here in the Charlotte, North Carolina area who was, and then right down the road in Clemson, South Carolina, everybody knows about Dabo Swinney and the issue that he had with baptizing kids. You know, what I don't understand is, why is praying bad?
Well, I don't know that people are saying praying is bad. I think there's that feeling of, in any case, sort of putting someone in a position where they, again, have to pray as a team. But Brent, I want to move on to the probe in the next couple of minutes we have left to make sure I get a chance to ask you about this. When we're talking about prayer at a level when it comes to whether it's private or whether it's public, you as a Christian, does it concern you at all when a player, let's say in a post game, in many cases seems like sort of a matter-of-fact comment of thanking God for being successful, does that in any way make it seem less valuable? Does it make it seem less important when it's about, I was able to make a play at third base as opposed to praying in private? Is that an example that gets more people to want to hear more about what that person has to say or less?
Yeah, I know. You know, I've heard people talk about, I believe it was during the World Series with the Tampa Bay Rays and the Philadelphia Phillies, and Brad Lidge, you know, he had a great season that year. I think it was 47-47, including postseason on save opportunities that he made good on. He didn't blow a save that year, except for the All-Star game, but that doesn't count as that. And it was either Ben Zobrist with the Rays or somebody else on the team. I can't remember if it was Ben Zobrist or someone else, but they were Christian. And they were talking in the story that we did in our magazine about how they really wanted to win the World Series because they wanted to give glory to God. And so they lost the World Series. And he was like, God, I cannot, you know, I was going to give you the credit, and we lost. Like, I don't understand that. You know, we wanted to win, so I'd give you credit. Or maybe it could have been a selfish reason to win. Of course, we want to win. And then he listened to Brad Lidge's post-game interview, or, you know, he saw something, I think it was post-game interview, it may have been the day after. He saw a quote that Brad Lidge made and how it gave God credit. And he was like, okay, God, I get it. No matter if we win or they win or whoever wins, you're still going to get the credit, and you're going to do it how you want to do it. And so I've seen people also give God the credit or glory or praise, or, you know, I want to stay away from so many Christianese terms, but they applaud God even in a loss. And I think that's where I have, as a Christian, said, you know, if we're going to praise God when we win, shouldn't we also say, God, thank you? You know, even when we lose, even though that's a hard thing, because God is, you know, as a believer, God is sovereign. He's in control, and wins and losses, they're very trivial. Sports are very a trivial thing. We want to do our best to win, but God's still going to get the praise and the glory, or he should, even in losses.
Brett, that's all the time we have. I thank you so much for the time. Brett Honeycutt is managing editor of Sports Spectrum magazine. Have a good day.
All right, you too. Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out about new evidence related to an infamous Phoenix murder. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by SRP. Their grid supports new energy sources, like solar panels on a home. And because solar doesn't operate 24/7, the grid is there when you need it. Learn more at srpgrid.com. SRP, delivering more than power.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. It should be a sunny day in the valley today. 103 degrees is our expected high. Clear skies tonight with an overnight low in the upper 70s, and then similar conditions tomorrow. Sunshine and a high again of 103. Stay with us at 12 noon for Here and Now from NPR in Boston. Right now, mostly sunny skies, and it's 95 degrees in Phoenix at 11:41.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. U.S. corporations have billions of dollars that they're holding on to, what some might call cash hoarding. And earlier this week, the Obama administration took executive action to discourage companies from moving their headquarters overseas to pay less in taxes. Today at 5:30, as part of the Economic Club of Phoenix's 2014 kickoff event, Jeff Cunningham, professor of practice at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business and a former publisher of Forbes magazine, will be talking about companies holding on to their cash and how it's affecting the overall U.S. economy. Jeff Cunningham is with me now. Jeff, what are the advantages to a company keeping its money?
Steve, the advantages are dependent upon your outlook. If you think that the world is getting better, safer, freer, more inclined to support and to improve cash flows, then I guess you'd spend money. Not very different than what an individual might do.
And so what are the disadvantages to the company of not doing it? And what are the disadvantages to the country when a company decides to keep its cash?
Let me take the first one. The disadvantage to the company are fairly basic. Cash doesn't earn a lot of return right now, so shareholders are missing out on what that cash could do. It could be invested in plants, in processes. It could be used to acquire other companies, expand overseas, and so forth. So shareholders are missing out on that, and companies are aware of that. That's not the reason they hold cash. That's the reason they'd like to spend it. The country would benefit, particularly if you agree that the private sector is the most efficient way to spend cash. The country would certainly benefit from releasing those funds. If you think about the $800 billion TARP program, it supposedly led to a creation of 3.6 million jobs. So imagine in the hands of the private sector what that might do. And that's really the rub. How do we get the public sector and the private sector to cooperate so that this cash can be released? Now, that's not entirely up to the government and the private sector. It's also about what's going on in the world.
Is it fair to criticize corporations that not only hold on to their cash, but also there's been, I've talked to members of Congress about this, I've talked to people in corporations who say that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was something that they just don't know. There's nervousness out there. And I guess I thought that when people are in the business and they decide to, whether it's a small business, they're entrepreneurs or not, there is a certain amount of risk to that great reward. So it almost seems like they're saying risk is something I'm really averse to.
Let's remember, the people largely in charge of making cash decisions, outside of the CEO who makes ultimately all decisions for the company, are the financial group within a company, usually under someone called a CFO, a chief financial officer. That's not very different from the person you bring your taxes to at the end of the year, and you want them to sort of reduce your taxes and maximize your opportunities, and that's essentially what the CFO is doing. So what they're behaving rationally. If they didn't, they'd be fired, and certainly as shareholders, we wouldn't want that person in charge of our pension funds. Our IRAs are all subject to the intelligent manner in which those people handle our assets.
Over the course of decades of business, and perhaps this has changed, is there a certain amount of, certain percentage perhaps, of assets that a company, a successful company, will logically hold on to?
Capital in the form of cash has quintupled, and the question is why? Let me just give you a few facts. There's $5 trillion of U.S. cash sloshing around in the vaults of American companies. Let's just take the non-financial companies, because those are the ones that really are just hoarding the cash, if you want to use the term. That comes to about $1.7 trillion. Mm. Of those, half of that is probably technology companies, and they represent half, $450 billion, of the total amount of U.S. cash overseas. Now, before we get excited about that and what that could do for the American public, let me point out that that the tax return on that, America taxes cash assets from overseas income at 40%. That's versus the UK at 21%. That's versus Afghanistan at 20%. So you lose 19% bringing the money back here. Now, if they brought all their money back here, the $900 billion, and it was taxed at 40%, that's $360 billion, that runs the country for 1 week. It's not the answer to our problems.
Is there an answer to our problems?
The answer to our problems is get the government, first of all, to reduce corporate tax rates. Now, I'm not here just to make a policy statement, but think about a company. It's an entity. Everything they do is spend money, invest it, and pay salaries. What's left is surplus, we call income. That's either dividended to the shareholders who pay tax on that, or it's served, it's reserved as for investment, as retained capital. Why would we still tax 40% of that on top of that for the government when the average global corporate tax rate's 24% and ours is 40? Once the government can get together, make policy decisions, and reduce those numbers, those monies will be released.
How do we balance the needs of capitalism with, you know, companies, obviously, as you mentioned, they owe it to their shareholders, they owe it to their own futures to build something, to have cash on hand, to keep expanding, with the idea that they had opportunities to do something in this country. This is where they had their foundation, and then deciding to go overseas or whatnot or establish someplace else in order to get tax benefits. How do we balance that out with a change of policy here, but also having the corporations recognize that they should have it pretty good here?
The amount of capital, cash, that companies hoard, so to speak, is identical between companies that have overseas operations and those that don't.
Okay.
So that's more the risk factor that we talked about earlier. Remember, why do companies have capital overseas? It's very simple. Those are overseas subsidiaries doing business in those countries and paying taxes in those countries. Mm-hmm. Now, America charges a global tax rate regardless of the constituency of your business, and so they want to tax it a second time back here in this country. And that's the part that's unfair. But as far as owing something to the country, what we owe to the country is for companies to be as productive with their capital as possible. There's unlimited resources to invest in our country, and we need employment. But if the government doesn't have the courage to make the decisions to release that capital, how do they have the courage to punish companies that choose to keep it there to benefit their shareholders?
Well, you mentioned CFOs before, so I don't want to be fixated on CEOs. But over the course of your time at Forbes and being in the world of business, what makes a great CEO? Are there people who balance the needs of shareholders with the needs of their workers, with the needs of the greater country?
Yesterday, I was speaking with Anne Mulcahy. She's the former CEO of Xerox, a celebrated CEO, to be sure, responsible for the turnaround. Anne represents what the modern CEO is. First, she's a candidate for diversity as a woman. Secondly, she's a believer in people. She's a fantastic listener. She's extremely technically adept. She was chief financial officer, so no one could say that she's not as experienced or as grounded in the business as any of her predecessors. But she has a different world outlook, and I think that's where the CEO of today is. There are no more imperial CEOs. CEOs do not have or feel they have or even desire the power that they once had. Boards are very independent. I think we're just up against huge challenges, and they need all the input from employees that they can get, as well as customers and other constituents, including the government, if they're to be successful.
Jeff Cunningham, professor of practice at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, also a former publisher of Forbes magazine. He'll be speaking today at 5:30 as part of the Economic Club of Phoenix's 2014 kickoff event. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. In recent years, a number of local and national media outlets have covered the trials of Jody Arias extensively. Arias was convicted of murder in 2013. More than eight decades before that came the story of Winnie Ruth Judd, also known as the Trunk Murderess. A number of writers have looked into accusations against Judd and what crimes she confessed to, and the conventional wisdom went that self-defense was at least somewhat involved in the killings. But the cover story in this week's Phoenix New Times on newsstands tomorrow says there's a lot more the public hasn't been told. Robert Pala wrote that story and joins me now. Robert, remind us of some of Winnie Ruth Judd's background.
In October of 1931, she killed her two best friends in a little house on North 2nd Street. And then the story goes, with help from someone, she stuffed one of the bodies into a trunk and then cut up the other body and placed it in other pieces of luggage and then got on the night train to Los Angeles, where she hid out for a week. She was given a life sentence, but she was sent instead to live at the state mental hospital, where she lived for 1933, and she escaped the last time in 1962. So she lived at the state mental hospital for almost 30 years, mm-hmm. and she escaped 7 times while she lived there.
What is the continuing fascination with someone who committed murders in 1931?
The story remains interesting, I think, because it has a little bit of everything. It has murder and infidelity, social disease, drug addiction, beautiful young women, and what was in 1931 considered sex perversion. But what really keeps it in our interest and what made the story interesting or different mm-hmm. is the fact that Winnie Ruth Judd packed her two dead girlfriends into luggage and took them on a train to Los Angeles.
Your cover story in the New Times, there's a confession letter. Was this not known about?
It was not, and much to my surprise, it was not known about by any of the Winnie Ruth Judd experts. There's an infamous document in this case known as the drainpipe letter. So anyone who knows the story well enough knows that when she was hiding out in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. she wrote a confession letter, tore it up, and flushed it down the toilet in the Broadway department store. I decided about 5 years ago that I needed to see it in person. I had read transcripts of it, I had seen photographs of it, but I knew that it was at the state archives in Tucson. So I went to look, I thought, at the drainpipe letter, and what I discovered was this very different letter that told a very different story. It did not tell the story that Winnie ended up sticking to, which was a story of self-defense. It told a story that very much matched what she was convicted of. So I came back to Phoenix, and I started calling all of the historians who have followed this case, saying to each of them, hey, what's up with this letter, and what do you think it means, and what do you suppose will be done with it? And every one of them, to a person, said to me, what letter are you talking about? So then I sat back for 4 years waiting for someone to publish the letter or write about the letter or talk about its provenance to the case, and it never happened. So finally, I just wrote the story myself.
Okay, so these experts you spoke with, historians, you spoke with one of her later defense attorneys as well. Where did this letter go, and why would she have decided to come up with some other idea? I mean, obviously, she lived a heck of a lot longer, but other than that, what was the point?
Winnie Ruth Judd had a succession of lawyers, and the last of them in 1933 was H.G. Richardson, who was a Pinal County attorney. Mm-hmm. She hired him after her criminal trial. She was kept from taking the stand by her attorney, Paul Schenck. And Schenck, in Winnie's defense, did not use the self-defense argument on her behalf during that trial. So she hired Richardson to say to the Superior Court, we're appealing this because she wasn't allowed to defend herself properly, and her attorneys failed to. And then, in an affidavit attached to that appeal to the Superior Court, he explains, quoting Ruth, what took place, which was that Sammy Samuelson, one of the two women, came at her with a gun, and she defended herself against the two women and ended up shooting both of them in self-defense. So he files this letter, this appeal and this affidavit on March 30th, 1933. And the next day he says to her, okay, so now what I need for you to do in your prison cell in Florence is I need for you to sit down and write to me in confidence what actually took place so that I can then build a defense for you, assuming that we get this appeal. And she sits down, again, the day after, 1 week after she has told her new attorney, I killed in self-defense, she sits down on April 6th and starts a letter in which she says, I was really upset because Anne LeRoy was sleeping with my boyfriend and mocking me about it. And so I went over there and I killed her on Saturday morning. And then I killed Sammy because she was trying to get the gun away from me. And Richardson looks at, as far as I can tell, her attorney, Richardson, looks at this and says, I can't use this. She just told me last week that she killed in self-defense. I went to Superior Court and argued on her behalf. Mm-hmm. And so what he did was he took that letter on April 9th, the day after she finished writing it. She wrote it on two different occasions, April 6th and April 8th. He took the letter and he locked it in a safety deposit box. And then he died in 1944. And he apparently gave instructions to his wife, Fern Richardson, don't show this letter to anyone, please. After I'm gone, just hang on to it. And let's make sure that it doesn't get out until after Winnie Ruth Judd is long gone.
Was there any indication that Winnie Ruth Judd was nervous there was something that she was hiding that people would find?
Yes. Donated along with this new confession letter was a stack of letters that Winnie Ruth Judd wrote to H.G. Richardson's wife, Fern, in 1952, demanding that she return that letter. And the reason that she wanted that letter back so desperately was because she was trying to get a new sanity hearing in 1953. And she wanted to make sure that any incriminating evidence out there would not prevent her from either getting this hearing or being deemed sane. And there's enough craziness in this letter that she certainly had something to worry about. Also, she admits to a crime in it. For my money, those letters demanding that Mrs. Richardson return the original letter, tells me everything I need to know about how concerned she was and about its provenance, its importance to the case.
What does this mean for this history we've all taken as fact about Winnie Ruth Judd?
I think it's important because there are so many written histories about her that take up her self-defense plea. What really surprised me while I was researching this letter for several months was the number of people, librarians, historians, lay people who thought they knew the story, who said to me, please don't report this story the way that it's been told in the past. So people apparently were on to her long before I stumbled across this letter and decided that maybe I should research it. I didn't want her to be guilty. I didn't have any idea that she should have been found, that her story should be different than it is. She was found guilty for killing Anne LeRoy in bed, and that's what she confesses to, not only in this letter, but in her earliest testimony in 1931, in versions that she told in private to her legal counsel. It matches a version that her husband told the pardon board. Her husband finked on her. It's the same version that she forbade three of her attorneys to tell in court. It's quoted by the prosecuting attorney in her criminal trial from a secret session that she held at the state pen. It matches up three or four different times where she told the same story. There's a 1933 jailhouse interview with Sheriff James McFadden where she tells this exact story to the sheriff while she's in prison. This is the version of the story that she told at Jack Halloran's indictment hearing. This is this version of the story matches the Los Angeles Examiner version that was published in late 1931, dictated by her husband and signed by Ruth Judd. So, you know, there's a lot of evidence out there that, in fact, while she didn't necessarily want to be convicted of the true story, that she had been telling it, at least privately, and to her legal counsel, repeatedly for a couple of years. Someone finally told her, hey, you need to stop telling that story.
Robert Pala, his cover story on a confession letter by Winnie Ruth Judd is online at phoenixnewtimes.com, and also pick up the